et cetera, and others versus receiving a portion of taxation, willing to encourage on that bus, Laura Ann Kirkendall, Common Council, Mark R. Hearing Attorney General, John W. Daniel, the Second Deputy Attorney General, Heather Hayes Austin, Senior Assistant Attorney General, J. Duncan Pittsburgh, Assistant Attorney General, three.
You may proceed.
Being pleased to court, I'm William Byrd, and here with Kelly Kirkendall and John West, who represent the appellants, the Wolford family, in this case. This case involves the Wolford's generous donation of a conservation easement worth $12.4 million. An easement given to the Commonwealth as part of an important tax credit program. And the case involves an attempt by the tax department to take away every penny for the tax credits awarded for the easement. The appraiser in this case, Mike Simmelin, previously performed nearly 100 appraisals of conservation easements. And the tax department never challenged any of them. But this time they said he did not meet the definition of qualified appraiser. They're wrong about that, and the trial court erred when it agreed with them. What is most important here is what the General Assembly said when it created the Conservation Easement Program. It said that qualified appraiser in state law means what it means in federal law. And federal law is very clear, because the Internal Revenue Service has issued guidance on this point. 2006 notice, we discussed it in our brief. The IRS explained that if an appraiser is licensed by his state to appraise the property at issue, then he is a qualified appraiser for that type of property for purposes of federal law, which of course governs here. Everyone here agrees on two things. One, that Mike Simmelin is fully licensed by Virginia to appraise the Wolford's property. And two, under the IRS definition, under the federal understanding of federal law, Simmelin is a qualified appraiser. But what the tax department has said, in effect, that the IRS is being too lenient with taxpayers, and that the state tax department knows best what federal law means. They say this court should disregard the 2006 notice. But that makes no sense. The federal law that defines qualified appraiser incorporates by reference regulations and other guidance on what the term means. You see that in the statute we cite on page 19 of our brief. Well, 2006 notice is guidance.
So every notice is codified by reference as a matter of statutory law?
Not every notice, by no means. But this particular statute that defines what qualified appraiser means as a matter of federal law, does refer to guidance. And therefore, this notice does carry the weight of law.
Well, suppose a later IRS commissioner decides that that notice was inaccurate and defines it differently, so the statute is constantly being morphed into whatever the bureaucrats say it means?
That would be the case if bureaucrats changed regulations, which sometimes they do.
Well, regulations have the force of law, but notices don't.
But regulations have the force of law until they are changed. If change is the issue, regulations can be changed, as guidance can be changed, but this guidance has not been changed. This guidance has been on the books since 2006.
But it could be, under your analysis.
It could be changed. So regulations could be changed. The statute could be changed, but for now, it is the source of understanding about what federal law means. And
well, when a regulation is changed under the APA and when a statute is changed under the APA, the common denominator is democracy. When a bureaucrat, lawyer issues a IRS notice, there's no democracy legitimizing that.
Where there is the least democracy legitimizing anything is in what the tax department has done. They have not published any regulation. They have not published any guidance. And this court has said in the Nielsen case that tax department rulings not expressed in regulations are afforded no deference and entitled to no weight. This is not even a ruling by the tax department. This is just their ipsy-dixit for this particular case. But even if you don't look at the notes, what does type of property mean? They talk as if this statute dealt only with real estate, as if this federal statute dealt only with donations of real estate. And if that were true, then maybe type of property is some subcategory of real estate. But that's not what this statute does. This federal statute deals with donations of all kinds of things. Art and books and automobiles and stocks and bonds. And yes, real estate. And in a statute that deals with all kinds of property, type of property means nothing more than real estate.
So that means that an art appraiser who's trained to value and estimate the value of art can estimate the value of used tractors?
Because that's exactly the point. That is the purpose of the type of property requirement.
Okay, so used tractors are different from Mona Lisa paintings.
Certainly.
Why isn't mineral-laden property with unique attributes of valuation models attributable to that different from just commercial property generally or residential property?
Well, how do you draw the line? They have not explained that. So if you're going to start taking apart real estate, well, is it rural versus urban? Is it farmland? Is it farmland with trees? Is it mineral property? If so, is it sand and gravel? Is it slate? Once you penetrate that line of real property, there is no principal basis to know where to stop.
So then that's your best argument. Who has the burden of proof of drawing a clear line? And if the tax department can't do that, it doesn't apply here.
Well, the tax department cannot do that. If you're going to see some ambiguity in the word type of property, where do you go to find an opinion that you should give weight to? Well, this is a federal law, and therefore we should give weight to what the federal tax authorities say about it. And what they say about it is very clear. It's in the 2006 notice that favors us.
Well, as a practical matter, this appraiser has also appraised sand and gravel.
Yes, he has, on four different occasions. So, if you get away from the 2006 notice, and we think you should not, we think that's affirmative, and you're into a more loosey-goosey industry standards kind of approach, if you're in, for example, USPAP standards, and they didn't say that below, trial court didn't say it below, but they suggest it now. Well, what does USPAP say? USPAP says, okay, there are different, within the context of USPAP, there are different types of property, but your education and experience is something that you can acquire by self-study. You don't have to take a course entitled Mineral Appraisals in order to be qualified under USPAP. I've got qualifiers under USPAP. And we had experts lined up to say what the USPAP standards are. This is our assignment error number three. What the USPAP standards are and why our appraiser's experience is for sand and gravel appraisals, his self-education, why that qualified him as a matter of USPAP.
Now, the trial court went through the four prior appraisals and really kind of picked apart why that wasn't a sufficient basis for experience. And it seems like the kind of thing we would ordinarily defer to. Tell me why we shouldn't in this instance.
Because this is not a binding fact. This was a ruling of law. This was a summary judgment. You cannot say, as a matter of law, that these four sand and gravel appraisals...
Well, the overarching issue of law is, was he qualified? But there's these, you know, the factual determinations that go into what was his actual training and experience, and a finding that, well, these four pit, et cetera, evaluations aren't the type of thing that are sufficient.
Well, first, but that is just wrong. It is just wrong as a matter of law. It's wrong. But it is an area of discretion, as Your Honor's comment suggested a moment ago. This discretion in the finder of fact, well, he wasn't acting as a finder of fact. He was acting as a finder of law.
Can I interrupt you there?
When he cut off my client's case before they even rested and granted a summary judgment motion.
Can I interrupt you there? That's a very important dialogue you just had with Justice McCullen. Suppose you're right on your first point, which is that the 26 U.S.C. 170 statute says what it says, the feds have interpreted it, it's a reasonable interpretation, ties go to the runner anyway under federal law here, blah, blah, blah. So he's qualified. You've heard some of the arguments we've had in other cases. The next question is, they still can audit, they still can do their review by statute. One of the things they look at is not merely the qualification of the appraiser and the qualification of the appraisal, but also whether or not 512.1 valuation models were properly done. Am I reading what you're saying in your brief and your argument to say that if you win the first point, really what you won is a trial?
Your Honor, let me go through what we're asking for specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, under Assignment Error 1, we ask the court to rule that as a matter of law, Similine is a qualified appraiser of the Wolfe property. Under our Assignment of Error Number 2, we ask the court to rule, as a matter of law, that Similine's appraisal cannot be disregarded.
That's right. So that can't be set aside as not qualified.
The appraisal cannot be disregarded.
Right.
And to enter final judgment for the Wolfords.
Well, wait a minute. Why would that happen? You still have to determine whether or not, if you're the tax department, you agree with the valuation model, or whether you think there's something wrong with it.
Well, they have conceded that they cannot challenge valuation. And if the only basis to disregard the appraisal is on audit, now on audit, not at the early period they waive, but on audit, if they cannot disregard the appraisal on audit, then final judgment for our client. But if the court does not enter final judgment, but rules that Similine is a qualified appraiser, then we would ask for a remand before the proceedings on various points Your Honor raised, perhaps, but certainly with the right to call our six expert witnesses that were excluded.
I got that, but did the concession that they're not challenging the appraisal as false or fraudulently overstated, is that the same thing as saying we don't challenge the legitimacy, the weight, the merit, and the necessary inferences from the appraisal period?
Your Honor, that's not entirely clear. We do believe that if they can disregard Similine's appraisal, and we ask the court to rule this. If the court does not agree that he's a qualified appraiser, if the court rules with them on it, then under that statute, 58.512b, they still must decide what the correct valuation is and what the correct tax credit would be. We ask the court, as our final alternative request, to require them to do so if the court agrees with them that Similine is not qualified. However, we believe he is. We ask the court to rule on that. I'd like to be made to reserve our remaining time for the
law. Well, may I ask one quick question? I thought the tax department didn't exercise its right to require an additional appraisal in 30 days. And in fact, on JA 30809, department counsel conceded that they're precluded from challenging value.
That's correct, Your Honor. And all we're saying is that, number one, they cannot disregard the appraisal unless it's false or fraudulent, and they did not say it is, so the appraisal they're stuck with.
Okay.
If Your Honor nevertheless believes that they can disregard the appraisal for any reason, then they are required not to give our clients nothing at all, to take back all the credits. They're required to appraise the property and to give appropriate tax credits with our clients having an appropriate right to challenge whatever they may do in another court proceeding. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Duncan Pitchford. I'm with the AG's office here on behalf of the Department of Taxation. The question that's before the court is driven by the statutory language chosen by the General Assembly, and that is whether or not...
Well, let's start with the first point, which is you didn't exercise your right to require an additional appraisal within 30 days.
Yes, Your Honor. The provision that's in the code that speaks of requesting an additional appraisal within 30 days goes purely to the question of value. It's, and I believe I made this statement to the trial court, it's, I think your number is too high, and therefore I'm going to hire my own appraiser to go out and take a look and come up with a different number.
This is just your backdoor way of getting to that point.
No, Your Honor, that is not correct. The issue is, has the taxpayer met the requirements imposed by the code? The code sets forth the requirements that have to be met as part of this appraisal process. The appraiser has to be qualified, as that term is defined under federal law. The methodology that the appraiser uses has to meet the requirements that are contained in 58.1.512.1c. Those are all issues that have to be done, regardless of the question of what the end number is.
Let me ask you this. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off if you hadn't completed your answer.
Please, sir.
Is it the department's position that if it doesn't challenge the appraisal at the front end with its own appraisal, that when it's auditing something, the only thing left on the table are the qualifications of the appraisal or whether there's fraud? Or can it just say, well, we've audited this thing and we just have a problem with the number you reached?
The question on audit is whether or not you comply with all the requirements that are contained in the code in order to receive this tax benefit. And on audit, the tax department has its full audit powers to evaluate everything that's been associated with a particular taxpayer's tax issues. In this case, the pure question of valuation, maybe, maybe not, the tax department could challenge that specific issue. But all of its other audit powers are reserved to it.
That's very confusing, because on the one hand, in response to Justice McClanahan's question, it seems as though, but don't let me put words in your mouth, that you're saying that you've conceded the value. The only thing you're talking about is qualifications. But the review, as you point out, the audit statute doesn't limit it to qualified versus unqualified, appraisal or appraisal. It's everything under the statute, including 512.1, which is valuation. So I'm completely confused as to the department's position on that.
I'm sorry if it was confusing, Your Honor. The question of pure value.
What does that mean, pure value? The number? The ultimate number?
The number.
Okay, so does that mean that if you're wrong and you can't blow off the appraiser or the appraisal as being unqualified, the number stands? We don't remand it for retrial. We don't remand it for taking testimony on valuation models and endless appraisal debates. Is that right?
No, sir. The question of the number. Let's say I'm going to the bank to refinance my house. I hire an appraiser. He says it's worth $200,000. Another appraiser might say it's worth $180,000. They may use the same approach, the same valuation methodologies, they just arrive at different numbers. The issue here is the approach. It's not the ultimate number. If the sole issue that
you decide the approach isn't right, so the ultimate number is zero, and they get none of the tax credit that they were granted. So
that's
how can
correct.
You say, oh, value isn't what we're contesting?
Because we're not contesting value. We're contesting...
No, instead, you contest the methodology, and then you reach zero as a value. How have you not done that?
We have done that. Because, again, under the statute, the burden is on the taxpayer to demonstrate that they have met the requirements of the code. And that means they present an appraisal, from a qualified appraiser...
I understand.
...who has followed the methodology that is required... as set forth in 58.1.512c. If they don't have that, they don't get the award.
If we conclude that they do have that, then does their value stand? Have you past the time where you can challenge their value?
We have passed the time where we could come back and say, I think your number is wrong. There are a number of issues that were presented
Why?
In the trial court.
Why is that? I mean, the way I read 512 is, if you want to file this thing in the first instance, there's a window for the department to get its own appraisal. Understand that. So there's the front end demand for a credit. But then there's the back end audit, which is a different animal. Anyway, I'm just puzzled why you think your hands are tied when the statute doesn't seem to tie those hands.
Justice Cullen, I think that an alternative reading of the statute is as you suggest.
Okay.
In the audit period that the tax department reserves unto itself
right.
the full power of audit, and that means everything,
okay.
just like when you file your income tax return.
Right.
And, you know, in this
in other words, to use that example, department wouldn't accept my income tax return because the numbers just look completely off. And so they can get their own expert, whatever. But once they accept it, okay, now it's filed, but there's a window where they can come back in and start picking it apart and say, well, now we have a problem. That's the way I understood the scheme, but I may be wrong.
And that is the general taxation scheme. And in this situation, you have a taxpayer who made an application to the tax department for an award of tax credits, was given a letter that says, we're awarding you this amount of credits, but please be advised, we can audit this at any time within the statutory period. And they went forth and sold the credits on the open market.
But that's why your concession is either overstated or too subtle for any of us to totally get. Because when you concede that the 30-day period limits your rights, when the statute doesn't say that, it's just giving you an additional right, which is to demand a second qualified appraisal. But it seems as though you need to address this. It seems as though you've conceded that away, that your rights are limited, and that the limitation, as has been repeated, is you can no longer challenge value, even though you can challenge value methodology. And as you've heard from a couple of us, that's very subtle, almost too subtle for tax people to argue, because the thumb's on the scale against getting, but so subtle with tax law.
I guess a couple of points, Your Honor. The statement was made to the trial court. I made the statement that the 30 days, the ship has sailed on the question of pure value, the number.
Is that what actually the phrase you use, pure value?
I think I use the phrase, the number. The question of whether or not the number is too big. I think I made the statement at a preliminary hearing.
Well, an ordinary judge like me would say, okay, that means if you're challenging the numbers too big because of the methodology, you've just given that argument up. That's the way I would have heard that if I'd have been a judge.
Well, that was certainly not the intention, and certainly not the position that tax has taken throughout this litigation. And perhaps it is too fine of a distinction, but you know, as I stated earlier, this issue of, you know, two appraisers applying the same methodology to the same piece of property could come to a different conclusion as to the number.
I see the subtle point. It's just very subtle.
Okay, and so if the tax department in Virginia wanted to make a regulation about what the definition of qualified appraiser is, you could do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you haven't done that.
The tax department has issued a notice stating that they would, and just as the code does, follow the federal definition of qualified appraiser. Whether or not a person is a qualified appraiser is a term of art. It's defined in the Internal Revenue Code as to what that means.
So how could you have a different definition?
We don't have a different definition.
Well, I thought you just said you could. But you don't, but you said you could. The statute says that qualified appraisal prepared by a qualified appraiser as those terms are defined under applicable federal law and regulations. And you're saying that you have the ability to have a different definition?
If I said that, Mr. Chief Justice, I did not intend to do so. I thought the question was whether or not we could promulgate some guidance as to what we consider to be qualified appraiser.
And if the guidance was at odds with federal statutes or regulations, we'll get to guidelines in a moment, you would agree that you couldn't do that. They couldn't be contrary to federal statutes or guidelines or regulations.
To federal statutes or regulations, yes, sir. I would.
All right. So then, are we here on the very subtle distinction between guidelines and law and regulations? Is that what we're arguing about?
I don't think so. We're here because there was a appraisal filed with the tax department to appraise a piece of property, and the gentleman that was hired did not meet the statutory definition of a qualified appraiser. Now, there's been quite a bit of talk in the papers and here today about this issue of the IRS notice and do guidelines apply, do they not apply. If you look at the definition of qualified appraiser, as that's set forth in Section 170 of the Internal Revenue Code, there are two subsections, and the Roman numerals and letters get strung pretty far out. But the first one is the section referred to by the appellants, which talks about as set forth in regulations and guidance from the department. And that subsection, as we stated in our briefing, is the subsection that speaks to the more general issue of licensure. Do you have a designation from a recognized professional organization? Then there's the second subsection, the Romanet 3, which talks about for any particular piece of property, that appraiser must have the necessary verifiable education and experience in appraising that type of property. So the type of property, verifiable education, verifiable experience, is a more particularized requirement that the Internal Revenue Code imposes to ensure that the necessary accuracy is associated with an appraisal that is evaluating a piece of property.
So if he has a master's degree in appraising real property, you want him to have a master's degree in appraising sand and gravel? Where do you get that? Because he has experience doing it. He's done it four times in the courts of the Commonwealth. So he has the experience part. So it must be the education part. Where do you get a master's degree in appraising sand and gravel pits?
I don't know that you can get a master's degree in appraising sand and gravel pits, Your Honor, but those individuals that typically do this sort of work have master's and PhDs in geology.
Well, let's just assume for the sake of my argument that he's qualified, and that was a mistake. Under federal law, he's qualified. Let's also assume for the sake of argument that the 30-day deadline is not exactly the way you seem to suggest it to the trial court, that it doesn't limit the tax department's ability on a audit and review to examine 512.1 valuation models. Do we need to get to that question in this case? Because the concession below, unless you can find some qualification that I'm not seeing, sounds like approbate, reprobate. I'm not suggesting you did anything wrong. I'm not suggesting you misstated. I'm just saying that's what it looks like. You said one thing below, and it's a different thing. It sounds like you're saying now. The one thing below is we're not going to worry about the number. The thing you're saying now is we can audit the methodology to worry about the number. That sounds pretty the same to me. If I were a judge hearing that, that's what I would say. So what's wrong with that sequence of logic that I just gave you? Because you lose under that badly, because that goes back with an order from the high court to lower court to give them the money and the appraisal. What's wrong with that? Tell me the logic error.
I think the logic error is that the methodology question is separate from the number question.
Okay, so the approbate, reprobate point is where the fork in the road would be with you. Okay, I got
and
that.
May I ask you this? The part of the oral argument, there was a motion filed to continue the oral argument for an arbitration to take place. Is that completely derailed, or is that still in the works?
The motion was filed to allow for a mediation to take
a mediation.
The parties were unsuccessful in attempting to settle.
Okay. All right.
Is your concession below with regard to the 30 days a concession of fact or a concession of law?
Just a minute, I believe that would be a concession of law.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief.
Mr. Hurd, you have a minute four.
Very briefly, number one, I object to opposing counsel testifying about how these appraisals are typically done by geologists, he said. There's nothing in the record to show that. On page 22 of our brief, we cite for a different purpose the Asgard case, which shows a sand and gravel appraisal being done by a real estate appraiser with no such geological credentials. Opposing counsel referred to the verified education and experience part of the federal code. That is exactly the part addressed by 2006 notice. He overstates the audit powers. Yes, they can look at everything, but they can only disregard the appraisal if they find something that makes the appraisal false or fraudulent.
That's true, but 512.1 goes well beyond qualified versus unqualified. It goes into, let's figure out how the qualified appraiser appraisal use methodology methods and see if we agree with it.
But those parts of that particular subsection don't deal with the audit. In the audit section, it says they can only disregard the implication is they can only disregard the audit if it is false.
Right,
or
the
fraudulent.
Implication, but it's not what it says.
Expressio unis, exclusio alteris, that is the only reason they give. That is, by the legislature, that is the only reason they were given. Thank you.
Call the next case.